welcome back to New Books in American Studies. I'm the co-host of the channel, Lillian Barger. Today I'm speaking with Richard H. King, Emeritus Professor of American and Canadian Studies at the University of Nottingham. His book, Arendt and America, published by the University of Chicago Press, is the topic of this show. In an intellectual biography and transnational synthesis of ideas, King explores how the German Jewish exile and political thinker Hannah Arendt's American experience shaped her thought as she sought an alternative to totalitarianism. Her books, The Human Condition, The Origins of Totalitarianism, and On Revolution, display the marks of her engagement with the American Republic of the Founders and the possibility of its survival under the threat of mass society. King examines her corpus as she engaged with the diversity of thought from the Western political tradition to mid-century America, allowing us to see the range of her ideas. Her interests were neither social nor cultural, but the political sphere. In Cold War America, she became part of the moral center of the New York intellectuals and forged relations with people such as David Reisman, Dwight MacDonald, Irving Howe, and Mary MacArthur. Arendt expressed a continual concern with the nature of political action, the possibility of new beginnings, and the idea of the banality of evil, introduced in the controversial 1963 book, Eichmann in Jerusalem. Difficult to categorize ideologically, Arendt sought a worldly politic rather than politics based in idealism or pragmatism. Her thought influenced post-war thinking on political participation, civil disobedience, race, the Holocaust, and the meaning of republicanism and liberalism. King has given us a portrait of a complex and often ironic relationship of a seminal thinker with America as a place and a set of ideas and institutions. Here's my conversation with Richard King. Now, let me introduce you to the author, Richard King. Richard, thank you for coming and being on the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
I have the privilege of having Richard here with me today. He's going to share some thoughts about his new book. Your book is packed with significant ideas engaged by Arendt in her many books and essays. But before we get into the salient themes and features of the book, please tell us about yourself, your background, and how you came to write Arendt in America.
Well, my background, where I was born, grew up, has a fair amount to do with my interest in Arendt and the connection I felt and the enthusiasm I still feel for her work. And that is, I was born in the South, and in the era of the civil rights movement, that is, I came of age. I was born in 1942, so I came of age as the civil rights movement emerged. I was at the University of North Carolina when the movement, the first sit-ins happened in Greensboro, which was 50 miles away. So my whole life was oriented around that movement in the 1950s, but particularly the 60s. Now, the reason why that's important is, what I found in her work that was so valuable, of trying to convey what it was like to grow up in a racialized society, a society in which race was the dominant social, cultural, political fact. And I know there are all sorts of differences as well, but that's one salient thing about it that meant when I read Arendt, and the first thing I read was Origins of Totalitarianism and perhaps her essay on history in another one of her collections, something responded in me, and I knew I had to keep reading. At one time in my life, I judged people, fellow academics and intellectuals, about whether they liked Arendt or not. You know, that was my criteria.
You were a fan.
I was a fan, and still, at the end of the day, at the end of doing a book on her and end of a long time reading her, I'm still a fan, but I think well aware of that she's also human and made some mistakes, some both interesting historically, but significant mistakes. But I was initially definitely a fan. I think one of the interesting things about her work is, though, she attracts enthusiasm and support. There hasn't been quite the cult following surrounding her that surrounds Leo Strauss and the conservative political philosopher, who is a contemporary of Arendt. They knew each other in Germany before they came to the U.S. So there is a phenomenon of academic cults, and it may come out of situations like Germany and America where there's strong graduate education, where a professor has students and they hang on his or her every word. But she didn't get a full-time teaching position, and this was a new school for social research, till 67. And although she taught part-time at Chicago before that, but it was hard to have graduate students if you were only around half year at Chicago and some of these other places. I mention this because she didn't have a string of graduate students she trained.
That could actually fall in her footsteps. That's
right.
And continue her
carry
legacy.
On in a good sense, carry on in a bad sense.
Right.
You know, slavishly follow and look for people who deviated from her line.
Now, when I first saw the title of the book, I'm thinking, okay, what else can we say about Arendt? A lot of it's been written about her. There's an incredible amount of scholarship across disciplines, political philosophers and all kinds of people. Why another book? What is the issue that you're trying, you feel like has not been dealt with?
Well, the title of the book is Arendt and America. And it's intended to be about two things. And this, I suppose, is the thesis or the thematic focus. And that is, to what extent and in what ways does her living in America shape her thinking and her writing? She comes to America halfway almost exactly through her life. She's born in 1906, gets here in 41, dies in 75. So it's pretty much divided down the middle. So how much does living here as a mature woman change her thinking after she's already, you know, had her education? She had the best philosophical education in the culture at the time, German philosophy and mentors, Martin Heidegger and Karl Jaspers. So that's one thing. And the second thing is, to what extent and where can we see her influence on American thinking, either in popular form, the controversy over the Adolf Eichmann trial in 1961 in her book published in reaction in 1963 to that trial. How does her work get out into the public in general, and then specifically in academic areas like political philosophy, history, things of that sort?
But your book is much more than just a reception history here, because you're also talking about how America, how she shaped America and contributed to America, but also how America shaped her
thinking.
That's
right. Yeah, it goes both ways.
It goes both ways. One of the things that struck me is throughout the book, did Arendt believe that America was exceptional?
Yes.
Why?
Why psychologically, in her own terms, I think, is that America had saved her life and her mother's and her husband's, to be specifically and very personal. I think it's hard to imagine for most of us how indebted an immigrant, a refugee, feels to the country which gives them safe haven. So I think that's one reason. And it is Bernard Crick, a British critic, but admirer of Arendt, said it's about some of her works, a Valentine to America. That is, here's why you're so, you know, I like you so much. That said, it's never just that, because she's well aware of real problems. She has her own particular set of perspectives on America as an educated European, which is really is a quite special case of a special rhetoric, you might say.
Well, was her interest in America, it seemed to me from your reading your book that her interest in America was not really about the actuality of America, but it was about the idea of America. And she keep talking about the founding event.
Yeah.
It's almost like she was stuck in 17, you know, 87.
76 to 83 to 87,
she
89.
She was stuck in that period.
That is the period which she works most in and with, the founding, the framers. The figures are predictable ones, although her favorite among the founding fathers, so-called, is John Adams, strangely enough. But Jefferson, Madison, a bit less than those first two, does some stuff on Tom Paine, of course, is English by birth and came over. And after that, her knowledge of and her engagement with American political reality is intermittent and spotty. She doesn't know much 19th century history. So, for instance, she has a particular idea of what the American Revolution was and how it was different from the French Revolution, that she claims the American Revolution didn't address the social question, which was the 19th century euphemism for poverty and more than just poor, but want and misery. And she seemed to, she got testimony from Jefferson and Franklin and others who were abroad in France and England, and Paris and London at the time, you know, which described scenes of the direst poverty and them saying, we don't have that in America. Now, the problem is, of course, slavery. Now, she's often accused of ignoring slavery. She doesn't. There's 6 or 7 pages in her book On Revolution, which is 1963, where she hit, you know, she knows exactly what slavery makes people invisible. Poverty does, but also race makes them more visible on one level, but it covers up the human reality in another. She scores the framers for being unique among modern revolutionaries, by which she mean American, French, on to the Russian Revolution, and in being relatively free of outrage and a sense of injustice. They are cool characters.
They really are.
You know, and pulls no punches on that. She admires them, but she's a character like Robespierre in the French Revolution, who she sees as really a dangerous fella for some of his ideas, but she honors his passion and sense of injustice in France, the existence of extreme poverty. So she's often accused of herself ignoring the social question, and to a certain extent does, but she's very much aware of what she's leaving out or underplaying.
But is that because she doesn't believe that politics is the place where the social question is to be addressed?
Yeah.
She has a very dualistic view of the world, right?
Yeah.
The social, the private versus the public.
And the public.
Yeah.
It's, I think, more than dualistic, although it certainly functions at the social v. political.
Right.
The private versus public is a fundamental dichotomy. But I think she really has a view of the world in which there's several spheres, areas of activity in which we live and move and have our beings. And different values and different traditions and practices are appropriate to them. So a certain kind, there's a morality of the private life in which one treats one's wife and children, if one's a husband, or, you know, the private virtues. But they have no purchase on anything in the public sphere. We are out of our minds if we go out in the public sphere and try to treat our friends or our enemies in the way
some of the neo-orthodoxy of Niebuhr.
it could be. We
immoral man, moral society.
Yeah, we have to know where we are before we know how to act or what is appropriate sort of action. So though there's a universalist streak in Arendt, there's also very much a notion of politics has a different set of moralities, or she would say principles, than the private life.
Now, she has a very idealistic notion of the founding of the nation, which she really builds an entire political philosophy around this moment. That doesn't seem to last very long. At the same time, she's experiencing America in her contemporary time. And she's there's racism, there's anti-intellectualism and conformity, which she notes. So how does she, it seems like she's kind of glossing over a lot to get to this, back to this pure America ideal.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. I think, it's surprising, let me put it this way to start out, it's surprising that she doesn't have more of a decline narrative of American history. That is, it started with the rescue of politics. That's what her story of the founding is, and the Jefferson's Declaration is the ideal way for speech to appear as action and so on. And this is a recovery of the republic. Republic's the key political concept with the big R.
The big R.
And you know, it's the public realm. And liberalism for her, the counter ideology, the counter political impulse in America is the pursuit of self-interest, however defined, whether individual self-interest or group self-interest, that is interest group liberalism, we come to call it in the post-war world, or interest group pluralism. So she sees a great moment and then a constant threat to that original idea and an idea of political institutions. But hers is more cyclical. She does see decline, but she always sees the hope of an upward turn again.
So there's progress.
She didn't believe in progress, but there is possibility of, there's the hope of improvement. There's nothing automatic about it.
Now, let's talk about, now we're going to get into like her political philosophy, which actually you say she's not really a political philosopher. She's a political thinker.
Yeah.
So let's think about her thinking. So how did she view politics? Yeah. How did she define politics? What did she think the role of politics was? And how does she see politics, the problem of the political in light of Nazi Germany?
What she finds in America, even in the present, even in the late 40s, she comes over in 41, and then after the war is the real beginning of the story of her intellectual life in America and writing about America. She's already reading Tocqueville as Democracy in America in the mid-40s. So she's trying to inform herself about her new home. And what she still sees, even though there's been a falling off and a return, American politics is about rise and enabling one to rise in status and self-interest and everything. She still thinks the ideas and institutions that she found in America are an antidote to what she had left in Europe. Not just totalitarianism, but a kind of, I guess you would say, a cynicism. An inability to imagine starting anew. This whole phrase is not starting over again, because that's repeating the past. It's starting anew. The great movement and event that gives her hope, ironically, is what happens in Hungary in 1956, when the Hungarian uprising and throwing the puppet government out. And she sees that's the return of the possibility of politics. The central notion, and almost a synonymous idea for her politics, is action, political action. It has nothing to do with violence or force, except the force of public opinion.
Participation?
It's participatory. There are two forms of action there she concentrates on. One is political action as performance. And I think here of Martin Luther King on the Mall, 1963. A command perform a great political speech, or some of Obama's speeches. These are political performances in the best sense. They are politics as performance. Then there's politics as participation. Some students of Arendt, Sheldon Wolin, among others, thinks they're really maybe not the same kind of thing, but Arendt thought of them together as both forms, ways of going beyond elected representatives to be involved yourself. Taking action directly in the name of the public rather than the private world, in terms of shared institutions rather than private.
And this reminds me of the lecture we just heard about
creation. You mentioned Arendt 10 or 15 times.
Right, about the creation of the public.
Yeah, that's right.
So if she's talking about participation, action in creating a public world that is separate from the social or the private world.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's right. And sometimes the possibilities, the raw materials are there. Sometimes they have to be called into being. I think if somebody listening wants to imagine something like an Arendtian political movement, I think of the civil rights movement. She had a certain interest in it, but not as much as she should have, I think. But it's a movement that, and in part, here's the reason, it was religious originally. And she didn't want her politics mixed with race, religion, or those kind of particularisms or divisions. But the civil rights movement is a movement from the grassroots up. It gets going on its own steam.
It leaves the churches and goes to the street.
Yeah. When it moves from being black grievances to being black examples of grievances that violate universal rights or rights that all Americans have, then it becomes a political movement. All American political movements practically originate in non-political contexts.
So what is the purpose of the political? Okay, so you create this public.
Yeah.
What's the purpose of it? Yeah. What does it do?
One answer, I think, would be, and this is a question often asked, and I think it is a point of vulnerability, and I'll come to why it is in a minute and how I think it can be remedied. But it is, she thought, we don't ask why this painting. You know, there is an aesthetic notion of the public realm that it is a place literally, she says, for the Greeks early on, where we remember who we are. We tell a story in a public space about who we are.
Who is we?
Who is a citizen is the same modern question, and it can be just males with age 23 or 22 or 25 with property. And the point of it, and I think this is the modern component, which she was less interested in developing, but I think you can be Arendtian without following her exact words, is to expand who we is. And that's what something like the civil rights movement did, or the women's movement.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It expands who a citizen is. She doesn't talk as much about citizens as a lot of Republicans in that generic sense.
But
does.
She also, the we is the purpose of the we is to expand, I think what she's saying, expand freedom.
Yeah.
How does she define that?
Freedom is speech and action together.
So for what end?
With each other. It can be about a lot of different things. I think what she should have said was, we have two ways of talking about that. One is it's internal goods. Alistair McIntyre talks about this in terms of practices. Certain activities have certain goods associated with them in and of themselves, being a painter, whatever else. They're external goods, and that is, what purpose does it serve in the world? And she tended to slight the what purpose does it serve
right,
in the world.
It seems circular, you know.
It is.
We participate to create the we, so the we can participate. So, you know,
yeah,
it's just.
Yeah, but it is a way a group has of talking about itself and celebrating its history. And, of course, there can be all sorts of disreputable histories of nations and groups as well. She thought politics had built into it, though she didn't talk about morality, certain principles. And one of the principles would be, for instance, her defense in the McCarthy era was not the First Amendment as such, but it was speech and action in public. It was speech and action in public. And that was how you maintain the public space in the public realm. And that was the justification for opposing restrictions on speech.
Now, she has a very interesting concept, the idea of worldliness.
Yeah.
And as that we need to recover worldliness, yeah, in order to have the kind of politic that she
That's
is.
Right.
And this has something to do also with her relationship with religion here. I think comes into play. So can you kind of talk a little
yeah.
bit about that?
I think the reason, to go back to the start of this thought train, and she liked to talk about thought trains, you follow out, then you start and then they crisscross, but was that she didn't want to associate herself with political philosophy as such, because she thought to use the term philosophy would be to draw on the tradition she had been trained in, which she thought was fundamentally anti-political. That is, it valued the other world, the world of Platonic forms, or in the Christian sense, in theological sense, the world, life after death, or the transcendent realm, above this world. So she was interested in thinking about how our arrangements in this world guarantee the existence of a public and a place to speak and act together. So that's why she said, I think politically, but I don't philosophize about it because I'm not in that tradition of thinking about this world in terms of a next one in a life after death. So that's what she means by worldly, not, you know, whether there would be food and drink for everyone around.
Right. Now, her thinking about America is different from Tocqueville's or Weber's. How are they different?
As far as Weber goes, Weber was very interested in, for instance, the day-to-day workings of politics and day-to-day how businessmen went about their business. And, of course, the famous association of religion and business in Max Weber's work. And he did a lot of the research for his Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism in America. He had relatives in Mount Airy, North Carolina, down the road here from Washington, you know, 200 miles. So there were differences there. Arendt's mentor, Carl Jaspers, had been the student of Max Weber, and Weber was one of Jaspers' heroes. Arendt didn't like Weber, her liking of him ended with his German nationalism. That is, he was a strong German nationalist, and Arendt thought that Weber was too caught up in the German idea and was a strong supporter, Weber, in World War I. Tocqueville, she uses often, mentions, but though she lived in America for 35 years, she probably traveled around less in America than Tocqueville did and had a concrete sense of how things worked.
Okay, there were several big problems that she dealt with. Besides trying to define the political and what that means, she dealt with the issue. I want to go back and talk a little bit more about how she splits the world into these spheres of political, social, and private. This seemed to cause actually more problems in her thinking than it solved.
Yeah.
Can you explicate that a little bit?
Well, yes. Her general idea was that as social beings, we are either concerned with personal advancement and rise in status, or we are the plaything and genuinely at the mercy of social forces. And she thought the essence of the social was lack of freedom. We think we're free in the same way we think we speak freely, but we learn language. We learn language and learn to be social in remarkably similar ways, and it's learned to come to terms with necessity. Whereas the mark for her in a certain tradition of the political is not about power and violence and secret police on every corner, although she certainly had her experience of that, but it's about constructing an order that will last where we can act and speak.
But it's a world outside of necessity.
It's a world that's intended to be outside of necessity. So she was against all those.
And that's sort of the essence of civilization, is it not?
Yeah, it's to escape the realm of necessity. There is a certain suspicion of the biological and the material in Arendt, even though she very much adhered to this notion of worldliness. That we live in a world, and that's there's no appeal to another one. We have to make our solutions and create our problems and the solutions to them in this world. But one of the angles on the social versus the political is that she thought it corrupted or ruined politics when it dealt with social problems, that is, solving biological problems, solving the problem of poverty, not because she wanted people to be poor, but that it gave too much power and the force of necessity, biological necessity and moral necessity to the state that was trying, or the movement that was trying to solve the problem. The Bolsheviks, Robespierre, everything was justified in the name of creating a realm of material freedom rather than political freedom. So it was a preference for the material Bertolt Brecht, who she was a big fan of, and in German had this phrase, first comes eating, then morality. And Arendt's notion was that's desperately wrong. You know, you can't give up your act as a free action, acting as a free person, in order to have, for the sake of having enough food as such.
Okay, now this kind of dovetails in my mind to her thinking on race and ethnicity in America, because they're markers. Race is a marker, right. Ethnicity is a marker, yeah. And I think in the public that she's trying to create, these markers aren't there.
Yeah.
But in reality, yeah. In America, this is like impinging continuously.
Yeah. They are biological, too, in the sense that they are physical markers quite explicitly. So, here's an interesting thing. She was very much originally against the state of Israel being a Jewish state, because that was using religion as the hegemonic marker for that political.
But it wasn't
order.
Just the religion too; it was also the ethnic.
Yeah.
The ethnic.
Add that one too. She didn't want those kind of particular identities to impinge on the universal identities within the political context.
Which brings the whole thing of her. She's a little alienated, or a lot alienated from Jewish Americans, and she talked about there was a quote in there about her saying, "I don't love the Jewish people
as a people.
As a people.
I only love individuals who may be Jewish, may be Christian."
Right. What was this? Is all wrapped up in this race?
It is. You're right, and it was always to try to, although she wasn't totally consistent, always trying to be. To strike for the position that would universalize goods rather than restrict them according to certain markers, to use your term. She did finally come to accept the state of Israel, but she wanted it to be a binational state. And by nation, she meant roughly what we mean by ethnic. That is the notion of the nation state. The state is the state apparatus and the legal system and everything. And the nation part is the culture of the people. And so all these things like race and ethnicity are okay in the national, but not in the state sphere.
Right. And she's also trying to negotiate difference and equality, right? She's always constantly has this tension between making sure everybody's, reaching for equality, but then there's this recognition of difference. And then she's got the world split between the public and the private. I mean, it is how she keeps it all straight.
And does she keep it all straight? I think one of the problems with her writing about school desegregation and the case of Little Rock, Arkansas, and the desegregation of Little Rock Central in the late 50s, and for those the readers don't know, she wrote an article that was published in Dissent magazine, and it said. Basically, she was expressing doubts on the wisdom of the federal government's attempt to desegregate Little Rock public schools. And the main reason was, she said, public schools in America are primarily social institutions. That is, they are an extension of the neighborhood and the family. Those are social institutions. And as such, parents have a kind of extended right over their children and those kinds of institutions. She said, buses, restaurants, public accommodations are, even though they're privately owned, are de facto public institutions, and you can't discriminate either in hiring or marriage. She said the biggest scandal in the South and in American situation was their prohibition on intermarriage.
Which is interesting, because that would be like the most private, socially implicated institution.
That's right.
But a community would want to forbid that.
But that's totalitarian and going inside the private sphere. That's what she left Germany, or had to leave Germany, about. And one reason it was controversial was that none of the black leaders or leaders of other ethnic groups wanted to admit, she would have claimed, that actually intermarriage was a live option for their people. She thought who you married was a human right.
You just brought up a whole another area of thought that she dealt with is the, how she refined human rights, the right to have rights. And her, how she viewed the whole movement, you know, within the UN as it is and the international community as it's developing the idea of human rights that we know today. Yeah. So I really like for you to talk about that.
Yeah, well, it at the end of the war, she published an essay in the early 45 of Universal Guilt and Responsibility is a rough title. But what it said was the world's faced with a new situation. And basically, it was a racial analysis of the post-war world, what was coming. What she saw in the Holocaust was she thought would be expanded out, where race became a political fact and a galvanizer of political movements. And she thought that would be absolutely disastrous. And so we have to strike for equality rather than tolerate racially oriented political movements or nation states. So that was one thing. She thought the Nuremberg trials, she wasn't against them, but she thought there is no way to adequately, and this became one of her definitions of radical evil. Like what the Nazis had done in the camps and the Shoah or the Final Solution was commit crimes that could neither be punished adequately or forgiven. That is, they were beyond the capacity of the positive law or even, you know, international law to punish. So she thought things like the Nuremberg trials were kind of useless. She didn't pay much attention to it. She changed by the time the Eichmann trial, Adolf Eichmann was captured in 1961. She came to see that trials were one of the few places where individuals were called to account and had to speak as individuals in public in a judicial forum. So she shifted her interest in some ways after all in revolution from the political sphere to the judicial sphere. So,
and she also had a real problem with Israel, I guess the state of Israel that tried Eichmann and under the premise that it was a crime against the Jewish people. Yeah. This was problematic for her.
Yeah. So there were two in the Eichmann book comes out in 1963 in the first several pages. She says basically that the justification of the state of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, prime minister, is the basis of the charge against Eichmann is it's a crime against the Jewish people, as you said. And that was the fundamental notion that only emerges after the war, the notion of genocide. Now, that's not her notion. It's a man named Raphael Lemkin, who is also a Polish Jewish emigre, came to the United States. So Israel had based its case on the genocide factor. What she said was that Jews were the particular people in which a violation of a crime against humanity had been committed, and she said, on the body of the Jewish people.
Right.
So there was a kind of, not incarnationist, but there was a kind of bringing together the two notions and what she thought the state of Israel should have argued on the basis of.
So what does she mean? I mentioned this before, the right to have rights.
Right.
What is that notion?
It's a really hard one. And the interesting thing is that she's very well known for that resonant phrase, and it is, and I'll come to it in a minute, but she hardly ever talks about rights anywhere else in the world. She doesn't come out of a rights talk tradition. That's American and Anglo-American liberalism. She comes out of a German tradition in which rights, Recht, and equal law as well as rights. So this right to have rights is an aberration almost in its expression in her thought. But what she saw an enormous failure of international law and international oversight of peoples in the interwar years. And what the lesson she took away from it was that human rights without enforcement from a particular body were useless. You can appeal to them, you can go on about them. But if there's nobody to argue them and to fight for them on your behalf, they're useless. The League wasn't going to do it. And so strangely, she comes back. The nation state, which is in some ways that part of the problem becomes for an inadequate solution. But the nation state is where you get somebody fighting for your human rights.
So then the purpose of the political is to secure rights.
That would be
the natural.
It would be the prerequisite for and the result of the right to have rights. But there's, again, I think that when you read Origins of Totalitarianism, it's very striking the passion with which she expressed her disappointment with notions of human rights, really, and that this, we need, she says, you need a space where speech and action count for something, and that is part of what it means to have rights, but the right to have rights, that first right there, is a kind of almost a natural rights position, like life, liberty, and pursuit. It's a meta right. It's a right that gives us all right. The other subsidiary rights.
Okay, let's talk a little bit more about her social thinking or cultural thinking, because she was intimately involved with the New York intellectuals and Reisman. And what was the concept of mass society? Right. And what did she think the threat of mass society was to this American Republic? Mm-hmm. She thought that was one of the biggest threats.
Yeah, that's right.
Why? And what is it?
What she saw in the post-war world was the rise of what she called mass society. And to put several things together in her thought, she really thought the totalitarian regimes of Nazi Germany and Stalin's Russia, Stalin's Soviet Union, were early and explicitly constructed mass societies. These are societies without structures of organizations, of clubs, societies, in which the government acts directly on the people. So one characteristic of mass society is no social institutions. And here's where there is value in social institutions in protecting us against the power of the state. So they can be useful.
Civil society, is this the same concept?
Civil society is some concept, and she never quite gets all the way there, but Tocqueville is much bigger on civil society as a protection against the state. But I think she learns from Tocqueville, but there's still that protection. But the point of totalitarianism was there was no mediating or blocking or buffering institution and protection of the citizen against the state with directly force imposed on the position. So the whole notion of citizenship, of political action or social protection disappears. So there are societies in which the individual gets reduced to a mere bundle of reflexes, she sometimes talks about. And this is where her whole theory of the camps comes in too. She saw the model of a mass society, or mass society pushed to its extreme, is what we see in the camps. Not the extermination camps. She made those distinctions, but the way life went on in the camps was the reduction of people to basic biological impulses, and most of those couldn't be satisfied in the camp. It was, she said, what the camps did, there's some evidence that it was even intentional, was to create superfluous people. It used people up. And that's
commodified.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we would call it now, right? People are commodified.
Commodified. Well, that's a little more organized. You know, at least she said once, the worst thing than not being exploited, the worst thing than being exploited is to not be exploited. So in the camp, they didn't even try. A slave is commodified, but a slave has to be kept alive. That's part of the workforce. The people in the camp are just worked to death, literally. And that's the degree or the extent to which the Soviet labor camps fit her analysis of the centrality of the camps for totalitarianism better almost than the Nazi
So how does she relate to this American mass society? I mean, how does she, because, you know, we didn't have extermination camps, even though we did have some internment camps.
Yeah. And the Indian policy and reservation. David Reisman, the sociologist, well, he was finishing up what became Lonely Crowd, and Arendt were in correspondence as the late 40s. And he would ask her those questions. But if the notion of mass society sees its extreme form in the totalitarian setups of camps, labor camps and all, to work people to death, there is a more moderate form of mass society, and that is the society that we increasingly live in which people aren't exterminated, but they're bought off by prosperity. That is, they lose their political function, they lose their political voice. All the what we would now say the institutions of civil society that give people a place and a way to act are rendered nugatory.
People are superfluous.
In a sense, they become superfluous in a political way that we don't need them for the function of the state.
Okay, so what is her relationship with the New York intellectuals? Can you talk a little bit about that? Her relationship there. Who were her good friends? How does she fit into their among that group?
Yeah. It's an interesting relationship. I think she's in some respects, at least before the Eichmann book, which was so controversial in 1963, she was probably the most widely respected New York intellectual. She and Lionel Trilling, I suppose, the literary critic at Columbia. The difference was Arendt was a bit older, though not older than all of them, but she was a German Jew rather than an Eastern European Jew, Eastern Europe and Russia. And that's a huge distinction ethnically, culturally, often politically. And German Jews and Eastern European Jews frequently have serious problems with each other. And I suppose the nearest analogy in white society would be urban and rural, be rednecks versus respectable middle class. Only this is longstanding in Europe as well. Now, one of the analysis of why her Eichmann book excited so much attention was that this, in America, why it was an American phenomenon, the protest against it, a lot of New York Jewish intellectuals and the people who read Commentary, Partisan Review and others, saw this as a German Jew once again telling everybody what was best for them and how they should think. And they claimed accusing European Jewry of giving in to the Nazis, of not resisting. This happened not to be what she said in the book. She pilloried the Jewish elites for betraying
the people,
the masses of Jews and Eastern European. But again, part of the irritation to outrage, and ran the gamut, was this notion of Arendt, and personally, she had this spirit of knowing better. She knows, you know, you want to know the truth, I'll tell you what the real truth is. Her friends were people like Alfred Kazin, a good friend, two of the most prominent non-Jewish New York Jewish intellectuals were Mary McCarthy, with whom there's a volume of letters between Arendt and McCarthy that are really good to read. Dwight MacDonald, the editor of Politics and one of the forerunners of New Left Politics, that magazine Politics in the late 40s. She had friends in academic life, and one of the interesting things was it took her a while to get over what she thought was the miserable capitulation of German academics to the Nazis, starting with her mentor and one-time lover, Martin Heidegger, who was famously became rector at Freiburg and gave carte blanche to the Nazis and, in fact, spoke for a new sort of mobilized notion of the German university. And a lot of her friends, young people her age, either went along with the Nazis or actively not just went along, but actively played a role. So it took her a long time to want to have anything to do with academic life. And so she didn't have a regular position until the 60s. She was the first woman professor at Princeton as a visiting professor in the 1950s.
Now, if you're looking, if we try to place her in American thought, she sounds liberal. At points, she sounds conservative. She seems to be kind of hard to categorize. I mean, there's not she's not like her own her own thing.
Carries her own compass around with her, and
right. And so you never really know where she's going to fall on something. So you can't assume. But how is she been categorized generally by others?
Let me say first of all, she denies most of the labels, but she did say once at least that at the end of the day, I'm not a conservative because the law of our life in society and living with other people, not society, and her specialization is that the world changes, and it's self-defeating to try to stop that change from happening. In the area of culture, her tastes, literary tastes, were sort of high modernists. She was one of the people responsible for translating and bringing Kafka into English and in the United States in the 1940s. She loved Faulkner, loved Melville, was a good friend of Robert Lowell and other contemporary American writers. So culturally, she was, I guess you'd say, part of a kind of literary modernist elite. She was not a theater of the absurd modernist and happenings and what becomes postmodernism. But she was, in her literary and cultural preferences, a modernist. That said, she believed that culture had to have permanent monuments and lasting creations as a way of giving us orient,
like a canon,
mm-hmm. guidance. The canon can change. I mean, she's bringing stuff in all the time, and she's rescuing stuff from it. She says the great weakness of American political thought is people have forgotten it. So there would be a case where you would try to recreate a canon and bring the founding fathers and other people
right.
back. So there's a conservative role of culture, but she's not a cultural conservative in that sense. So in her voting, if that's any indication, I think actually who people vote for is important. She voted Democratic most of the time.
Okay.
I think, it was a kind of liberal, but she didn't have much feel for social policy. The Democrats have been the carrier of right. the attempt to use the state to rectify economic and social injustice, which she, in her writings, claimed is a very dangerous thing, at least to try to correct poverty by political means. But in day-to-day politics, operational politics of day-to-day, she had no huge problem with it.
I'm going to backtrack a little bit because there's something that I skipped over and I didn't ask you. And in writing her book, The Eichmann in Jerusalem, she deals with the problem of evil. This is a big theme in her throughout her work, not just this work.
Yeah,
evil in its many presentations.
Yeah.
And she talks this phrase, the banality of evil. What does she mean by that? And it was rather shocking for people to hear that at that time, that she would consider evil banal.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Yeah. There are various clusters of meaning she associated with it, but I think one of the clearest ones is that someone like Adolf Eichmann and other Nazis, in the case of Nazism, carried out their jobs with a minimum of or no huge moral problems connecting them. They didn't particularly hate Jews. They didn't. Their every waking thought wasn't with ridding the earth of the scourge of Jews. It was a job. Now, one of the
is it like saying it's the routine of evil?
It's somebody said one of our best commentators, Shayla Benabib, says something like, she should have said the routinization of evil.
Right.
Or normalization of evil. What she said, because she was dealing with a man, it had to take on more pointed form. In some ways, it may have been a hostage to fortune to link it to a particular man, because people would always go, I remember when Eichmann, you know, was wearing his SS uniform in Budapest, and he was no banal figure. He was scary. See, the banal person she had in mind was a harmless desk murderer, she called him. Nobody had ever sullied their hands. They didn't go out and shoot people. Eichmann never killed anybody, although there was one charge that he did.
Well, it reminds me of the kind of military actions that we're doing now, where there's a remote, person at a computer sending rockets.
Drone warfare.
Yes, and it's almost like you can kill from a distance.
Yeah.
You know, war from a distance.
Yeah.
Which is very different from face-to-face combat.
Right.
When you have to look
at... You earn the right somehow.
Yeah.
At least if somebody's coming after you, go back at them. But if you're sitting in a sanitized lab in Colorado looking at drone photographs, they're part of a spectrum, but it belongs together. And her work on Eichmann is, though I don't think she really intended it that much in the following way, it was an example of the way bureaucracy has taken over and runs many of the functions of government. She called bureaucracy the rule by nobody.
I thought that was great.
Yeah. And so Eichmann is a typical character. He was more than a cog in a machine, but he wasn't a policy maker. And so he was somewhere in between. And that was the kind of guy, they were most of
them. Middle management.
Made the thing go. Now, the best phrase she used was, Eichmann had no moral imagination. He couldn't think what he was doing. Not that he wasn't dumb, but he didn't realize the moral implications of his actions consistently over and over again. He thought, after all this, he says at some place something like, I'd like to get together with the Jewish leaders now and say, I'm sorry if they're sorry. He thought they were as equally guilty of starting the war as the Germans. That is, this is a contest between two equal forces. But he thought, well, let's let bygones be bygones. Now, can you imagine after that somebody saying that, like somebody coming and killing your family, and like, well, let's let bygones be bygones. That's the lack of a moral imagination that she's
also
talking about.
He's also, in a way, within the Nazi machine, he is expendable.
Yeah.
I mean,
you can plug a lot of people in.
Yeah, you can take him out and put somebody else in. It doesn't matter. It's the task.
Yeah.
The routine task.
Yeah.
And that's what she means by the banality of evil. Yeah. You're like a factory worker.
Yeah.
You just do what you're supposed to do.
It's commonplace. It's unexceptional. But it arises out of a situation, she thought, in some of her earlier writings. She wrote about Heinrich Himmler, who was head of the SS and ultimately Eichmann's boss. But she had the same analysis of Himmler in 1946-47 that she has of Eichmann in 61. So it was a preoccupation in her thought from the mid-40s on of how did this happen? Everybody wasn't, Hitler and Heydrich and these monsters of radically evil people. Most of them were people who went home and lived their, mythical normal life.
It's her struggle with trying to understand what evil is and what to do with it and how to contain it. It seems to kind of haunt all her work.
Yeah.
Now, when you look at the whole body of work and I'm looking at your book, it seems like a lot of her ideas were sort of ill-conceived, underdeveloped. Sometimes the idea seems to be stillborn. I mean, they just seem to kind of, she kind of runs into a wall and then she drops them. Why is that? I mean,
I would say underdeveloped is a fair point about a lot of them. It's hard to know what ill-conceived would mean, but let me explain, maybe I didn't write enough about this, but she typically took up and stayed with problems that came to her. That is, she was provoked into by something happening or some phenomena, rather than having a systematic plan for the rest of her life, what she was going to work on. The Eichmann thing came along, the trial of Eichmann in 61, and she said to the New Yorker, Sean, the editor of New York, said, I miss Nuremberg. I've got to see this travel. Can the magazine, will the magazine pay my way and publish my work? And he agreed to it. It's in the film, the Margareta von Trages film on Hannah Arendt. So it was, she was opportunistic in that sense. And as Corey Robbins said, in the best sense, she saw something that she thought had to be dealt with. Now, that meant in some ways she had limited interest in it once she felt like she'd done with it what she wanted to do.
She didn't stay with something long enough to really fully develop it.
She wasn't a systematic thinker. She stays with things like you comment rightly. She's on the guilt and responsibility and evil in the mid-40s. And it's what she's writing about when she's dying in Life of the Mind, which I don't do much with, but in 1975. But she comes in and out of periods of using. Same thing with totalitarianism. Same thing with
themes,
the Republic. Themes, or as I mentioned a while ago, thought strands, I think was
right.
Her term. And so there is a quality of incompleteness at times.
Yeah, it was frustrating because in reading your book and trying to analyze her thought, I'm like, okay, but
where does it go from there?
Yeah, it's like the problem of the public. You know, what is it? What's it for?
Yeah.
We're going to create the public to create the we so that we can create the public. And it just keeps going. And I was never satisfied how you portrayed. And I know it's not your fault. It seems I haven't read all her work. So I'm going on what you're saying. What politics is, except maybe securing the right to have rights. That's it.
Rights to have rights. It's about that preservation. And I think I saw one interesting suggestion once. It said the real Republican institution for Arendt, that person thought, was the Supreme Court, because it's a continually involved in reinterpreting the meaning of the basic institutions. Okay. I'll tell you another example of the program is the Watergate crisis and the Watergate committee and that whole thing. Now that's, okay, there's a good example. It's preserving the Constitution. That's what politics is for. Is preservation of the Constitution.
So she's always going back to that founding moment of the nation and really has a great reverence for it.
Yeah.
In spite of all the history that's happened in the last 200 years, she still really believes in that.
There was some basic thing. But the two crises of the post-60s period, Watergate and Vietnam, sorely tested her commitment to, or at least her belief in the ongoing relevance of the idea of the American Republic. She came out of both of them relatively intact, but they were discouraging. And she came closest to having a kind of pessimistic, declensionist view of American history, how it's fallen off since the beginning.
Now, I'm going to ask you this. You already told me you're a fan. You were a fan. But after doing all this work, was she a great thinker? Or is she just considered great? Or because she had great influence at a particular moment, historical moment. And I think that's not the same thing. You know, it's like you think of her as a great thinker because it's a sort of an accident of history that she happened to be in America with a certain kind of education at the right time. Yeah. Or is she really on her own a great thinker?
It's a really interesting question. And people usually beg off by saying it's hard to say what a great thinker is.
Right.
She's not a thinker like Hegel or Kant, who's systematic. Okay, that's one thing. She is a great thinker, and I think maybe the term that the French use is better, a great moralist.
Okay.
That ultimately that concern with guilt and responsibility, the kinds of evil, probably underlie most of the other things. I think she was, her greatness lay in identifying problem areas. And I'll give you an example.
But there were moral problems, right?
She tends to, by the end, be most interested in the moral dimension of the problems, the degree to which I act. She had two notions that, for instance, passive resistance or conscientious objection, she saw as an ethical response to a public crisis. And that is, I don't want to participate in that because it'll compromise my conscience. She said, that's not political. Civil disobedience is a political reaction because we gather together and share our views on how to resist by our institutions the problem. So those are two fundamental. And Thoreau, she thought, Henry David Thoreau, though his essays called Civil Disobedience, was closer to being a conscientious objector. He wasn't political in the way she thought people should be political. He put his own conscience ahead of the good of the public realm.
Okay, so you would say that her enduring contribution is going to be the moral issues that she brings up.
Identifying the crucial moral issues in a broad sense of the modern world, and that is that war and that experience probably ends the modern age, the Holocaust and the Soviet experiment.
But she wasn't the only person at that point in time who was really thinking about World War II and the aftermath and the Holocaust.
No, there,
people are thinking, why? How does this happen?
Yeah.
What's wrong with modernity? Where have we failed? Let's rethink our theology or philosophy. Let's rethink everything.
She's not the only one, but she is one of the first.
Okay.
It's surprisingly how few philosophers address the issue, for instance, of the difference between responsibility and guilt. She, Dwight MacDonald, her mentor, Carl Jaspers, writes a book, The Question of German Guilt. But Anglo-American philosophy, they've gone to talking about, meaning and signification and the philosophy of mind. And some of that stuff's really interesting and really important. But it's amazing how many people don't take it up.
Okay. Where do you feel your book, or you hope that your book will be useful?
I think it would be to open up a different dimension of Arendt. And in fact, we've talked mostly about her philosophical and moral issues rather than as much about America, except for the framers and founding fathers. But she is all bound up in her American life and American intellectual life. For instance, she had not much interest in pragmatism, which is supposed to be America's philosophical movement. And there are some good reasons for that. There's some others, but there is a side to Arendt that our treatment of Arendt that says she's just a European that comes over to America, and it's the writing side of her work, but she's really addressing Europe. And I think that's wrong, that America plays as much a role, not saying this out of patriotic reasons, but America is important in her consideration of the nature of modernity as Europe is.
Okay, Richard, you have been very generous with your time. I have one final question. Mm-hmm. What are you working on now?
Where do we go from here?
Where do you go from here?
I don't know. I have some, a lot of other stuff I've written on Arendt and essays, and maybe look into collecting those. It's hard to know. I got interested in working on particularly the idea of the banality of evil on what are the breakthrough, what's a breakthrough idea? The banality of evil, she's very unique. It's a unique idea. It's almost, as close to originality as you can come.
Right, it is.
We can explain it and find other examples, and other people have said similar. But to have that idea, and that, I got intrigued. Are there other ideas in our world that are like new additions?
Right. So I think she reconceptualizes the whole idea of how evil works.
Yeah. Yeah. And that would be that. You said it better than me. And if you talk about the makings of a great thinker, it would be to change the way we see the world and give us a new language, or at least a shot at developing a new language for describing our world.
Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
And thank
My
you
pleasure.
To our listeners for tuning in to another edition of New Books in American Studies. It would be a pleasure to hear from you. Drop me a line at newbooks.americanstudies@gmail.com. This is your host, Lillian Barger.